philosophers in space.
Gotta be my pal. Tell me, am I a good man?
My space armor!
We get it, you're from space!
Captain, we've been attacked by some sort of force ray. Space air is flooding in.
What would Uncle do?
Zuko, you have to look within yourself to save yourself from your other self.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space, episode 92... How's it going, Aaron?
You mean subjectively or objectively?
Objectively, how is it going in your mind?
It's a trick question. It's terrible either way, man. Like, no matter what you're asking. It's all bad. Outside, inside, it's all bad right now.
There is one that's like where you ask a stalling question just because you already know like this is going to be bad. But what are you? And then the end, it's like, that's all the same.
Yeah.
Either way. We're terrible, everybody.
I did have one happy insight as I was prepping for today's work, which is the fun coincidence that my favorite philosopher and my favorite podcast co-host have the same first name. That hadn't occurred to me before.
I was going to try to come up with a joke, but I can't remember Wittgenstein's first name.
Oh, I want to say Ludwig.
I'll just say Ludwig. Yeah.
Yes. My well-known podcast co-host, Ludwig.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it is Ludwig. That would have been good. Hey, everyone, really pretend I made that amazing, amazing joke about how Aaron co-hosts a podcast with his buddy, Ludwig. Just that's a great joke, but Wittgenstein is such a great name that you don't really want to hear the first name. I don't have time for the first. Already the last name's great.
It makes me think he's a composer instead of a philosopher when I hear.
Yeah, Ludwig. Yeah, it's very similar, like Beethoven. Beethoven, you're done. You don't need anything else. That's
it's
a great
like Madonna,
name.
Right? Why bother?
Yeah. All right. Well, objectively speaking, we need to move on and talk about what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
We're still on HBO's The Watchmen, fantastic show. But now we're going to be focusing a little more in on the big blue dong of the show.
the throbbing centerpiece, do we want to say?
Yes.
He's tumescent with symbolism and metaphor. I could do the 10 things I hate about you shtick for a while. So anytime you want to jump in here,
go ahead. I'm not stopping you. What?
No, we'll save it for after dark.
What am I going to stop you?
We'll save our blue dong talk for after dark as usual.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess in that case, we'd better have Brian punch it.
Oh, whoops. Oh, I dropped my monster condom that I used for my magnum dong.
I'm out of here.
You're traveling through another dimension. Beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
So, yeah, this character, very interesting. I mean, we've kind of already gone into it in several things, including such episodes as every Watchmen episode we've already done. But just in case, I suppose it could be people who haven't listened to those. So I'm going to do my best because I'm not the comic book guy, but I've watched enough of this show now in the movie that I think I can explain. It's a science experiment gone wrong. It's a very original, origin story for a, well, he's not really a hero. He's not really a villain. So he's just a superman.
He's a force of nature.
I don't know about that either. A force of nature.
Yeah, we'll get into it. Don't worry.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a very directed force of nature, I guess. But he was doing some research back in the day, an experiment, and he got locked himself in his own damn chamber like a dummy. So I guess he was kind of a stupid scientist.
Yeah.
Did he go back in for his dad's watch or something?
Distracted by his girlfriend. He goes back in for his dad's watch.
Classic. And then, of course, you can't open the door. There's all, you know.
Yep.
Once you've locked someone inside a science experiment, The rules are, well, we're going to have to see this through. The risk reward is we want to know what happens if you're in there, so we're not letting you out. No, not really. I get it. Whatever. They can't let him out for whatever reason. So he goes, pshoo, 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 and there's a bunch of light show lasers. And then he like, what? Doesn't it, something weird happen? Like his skin like teleports somewhere?
He gets, pulled apart. And he's gone for a little while, and then pieces of him start to rematerialize. So, like, his skeletal system shows up at one point.
Right.
His central nervous system just hangs around for a second. Kind of a Boltzmann's brain kind of situation, just flittering into and out of existence.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. But then eventually the end result is he's a blue guy with magic powers, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How would you describe? I may need your technical expertise here. What are his abilities or powers or what changed about him after that?
I mean, his abilities are undefined, I would say. Like, there's no given limits as far as we can tell. So the only thing we know about that limits his powers is certain kinds of particles affect his ability to see the future, which plays a key role in a couple of plot points and over the course of Watchmen. But, like, as far as we can tell, he has the ability to take at an atomic level everything and rearrange it into anything else. Like, you know, he just has all the Infinity Stones in his head.
Wow.
But, like, I don't think he can change. I don't think we've ever seen him, like, roll back time or something like that. So maybe, you know, there probably are some limits to what he can do. But it's hard to know what the limits are because, as we'll talk about with his motivation, he quickly sort of loses interest in using them in a variety of ways. So we don't know what he could or couldn't do.
Yeah, that's what I love about this character. He's more limited by his psychology than anything else, or lack thereof.
Right.
It's more like focus.
Right.
It's just like becoming one with the universe kind of makes him lose his drive in some ways, sort of. So, but we'll get to it. Yeah, he clearly has some timey-wimey stuff.
Right.
But I don't think in like a time travel sense, it just seems to be like the movie we covered where his perception.
Arrival.
Yeah, it's kind of Arrival, but his perception is kind of at all places at all times in his life at once. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, we get the impression from him that it's a fully determined universe where everything that's going to happen is just what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, which I think you kind of have to have to have that sort of perception, but we've argued about that at long length. He's not like changing the stuff, you know. He's just kind of, and he's very accepting of it. It's kind of what's the word for it where you're just resigned to it, you know?
Fatalistic.
He's kind of fatalistic about it, I think.
Yeah, and they do in the show Watchmen some of the best writing ever in the second to last episode, playing with, you know, like if you were frustrated at all when we talked about Arrival and nonlinear time, go and watch the dialogue in the second to last episode of Watchmen, because it's the best send up of like a normal person trying to understand a nonlinear individual's perception of time. And it's just super funny. And it sort of sets up the need for the character to limit his powers further if he's going to have a proper flourishing life, which is the main thing that I want to talk about today.
Ah. Well, perhaps we should get to it, or is there any other expositioning you want to do?
No, I think that's good. I mean, I think there's a lot for us to cover here today. This is going to be kind of a philosophical keystone episode for us. It's going to tie the room together in a variety of ways, I'm hoping. Which was because that's what Nagel's goal was with this particular paper that we're talking about today, subjective and objective. This comes at the end of his book, Mortal Questions, where he, over the course of that book, has laid out what he thinks are a variety of examples of problems that arise because of this subjective-objective divide. And then he wraps up the book by kind of saying, look, these are all specific versions of this general form of a problem, and this problem is in some sense probably irresolvable, and that has important things. It means important things that we have to wrestle with as human beings. So And this is good, I think, sort of foundational work, because we've had folks sort of wonder and ask questions before about, like, what are the meaning of the concepts subjective and objective? And people have tried to define these in lots of different ways, and it can be really sort of tricky to get a grasp on them and figure out, like, what counts as an objective fact versus a subjective fact can get really slippery.
Yeah, subjective fact. Well, we'll get to it.
Yeah, well, yeah. So, right, naturally you think fact, you think objective, right? So objective, we generally associate with the external reality, the way that things are from no perspective in particular, right? So Nagel likes to bring up the view from nowhere or the view from eternity or something, right? The view from no point in particular. And so, you know, this view has risen to ascendancy as being sort of the equivalent of what is real. When we say something is real, we mean that it's objective because of science and because of, you know, the empirical revolution that has given us so much insights into the world, not mitigated through our personal biases, right? So there's a lot of value in developing a more objective perspective of the universe, because it allows you to interact and control that universe in more sophisticated kinds of ways.
Right. Like, you know, developing mathematics and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's been very powerful, math and science, and has done a lot of things for us. And it sort of created this aspiration that, like, the further we get from our subjective just view of what's happening, of the world of reality, the more, like, correct it is in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be, like, you know, not necessarily true, but also in a way, like, it does make sense that we think that.
Yeah, and the tricky problem here is going to be, I think both things are true. That, like, the view from the objective side is true, and the view from the subjective side is true, and we're not, it's not clear how to resolve these truths, and we don't want a world that is divided into two parts, right? Like, the world should be, so, like, the goal of the objective view of things is to subsume everything into that view and thereby give a complete account of the universe that doesn't involve depending on any biased subjective perspective, right? That's one way to understand the goal of seeking knowledge and truth. But the problem has been, as Nagel says, there are various subjective features or parts of the universe that seem to resist being reduced down to the objective view, that we really can't resolve the subjective down without remainder. And so what do we mean here by subjective? What he associates it with, and I think this is the right way to do it, is the right to associate it with the way things appear from a certain first-person perspective, which is something that we all experience directly, and it's something that gives us insights into parts of the world that objective science seems to have limits on what it can actually get access to on that side of things, because science is about the objective. And that's why. So to list some of the key examples of this divide that Nagel brings up is the absurd problem that we talked about last episode, right? The view of the meaning of our lives from the inside versus the outside. The moral luck problem that we talked about back when we did The Good Place is another example of, you know, looking at moral responsibility from the inside versus the outside. Personal identity, when we talked about the Ship of Theseus, and Altered Carbon and stuff like that, right? That there you have the problem, or the mind-body problem when we did Altered Carbon, right? Both of these are situations where, you know, the individual sees it one way and the universe looks at it a different way, and we can't seem to reconcile them. And then finally, the one that's also going to matter for us is the conflict between agent-relative reasons in ethics. So a reason that you have because of your personal subjective relationship with someone else, and agent-neutral reasons, like what you ought to do with regard to the potential outcomes from the point of view of nowhere. So we can debate how much each of those is really resolvable down to this kind of problem, but I do think that he's right that there is a similar tension existing in a lot of, almost all the major fields of philosophy, and that its unresolvability is why we're unable to make progress on certain issues. That makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you? I don't know how I feel about this idea that these things aren't reducible to the objective view in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But it might just be more convenient to look at them subjectively. Like, I don't know. Like, is he making the argument that states of mind are not reducible to, like, mm-hmm. states of the brain? It seemed to be when I was reading it. Like, that's part of his argument, potentially. Well, am I understanding that?
So right? What he would say is the subjective quality, the subjective nature, the what it's likeness, right? This is also the book where he talks about what it's like to be a bat. And that's another example right. where we know there's something it's like to be a bat, but we don't know what it is like to be a bat. And we can't know because the only things that we have access to are the objective correlates that go along with the subjective experience of what it's like to be a bat. And it's the same thing would be true if we develop AIs. I think we'll never be able to know for sure that there's something it's like to be the AI because we can only look at the objective features, but the subjective what it's likeness is not, as far as I can tell, necessarily correlated with any particular set of objective features. So we can't infer one from the other, and that they are fundamentally different, that the objective has certain properties, that it's observable from multiple perspectives, whereas the, and then you know, you can build machines to measure the objective, whereas the subjective appears to only be perceived from the first person perspective and is not sort of accessible by others in this kind of way, but is not reducible. So like you have attempts by folks like Daniel Dennett to reduce the subjective down to the objective through views like illusionism and things like that. But I don't think it works. I think they end up having to deny the existence of the subjective. And I think what Nagel is right about here fundamentally is that you can neither deny the truth or the existence of the subjective or the objective, and that reducing one down to the other is effectively having to deny the existence of one over the other.
Yeah, I don't know if I buy that. Like, I feel like it is, because
Mm-hmm.
Nah, I don't know if it's worth.
Well, I mean, I
worth debating, but
I'll say that with the free will, I think it's a good example of where it's really genuinely isn't reducible. That like, and so my take is on free will, we should go with the objective perspective, but that brings with it problems about how we assign moral responsibility. And then the other one that I really do think is, well, I think actually personal identity and the mind body problem are both good examples of this. As well, you know, we do have our sense of whether we are the same person over time, I think, is ultimately a subjective factor, a subjective feature, and that like no amount of measuring the, you know, which particles are in us, what parts we have from the outside could ever tell us.
Yeah, if the
person is the same.
Yeah, if we mm-hmm. Yeah, if we found footage of, you know, someone who looks exactly like Aaron doing something 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's no way for us to say that's you versus, you know, if you have a twin or something. Like the only way. But I don't know. But is that true? I mean, couldn't we hypothetically, you know, dissect your brain, get in there, see what memories and experiences you had from that still remain within you?
I don't think that we could. I don't think we can ever see the memories inside of someone else's head. I don't think that they have that those subjective mental states could ever be fully accessible from the objective, from the outside. That is what I am skeptical of, highly skeptical of.
Well, isn't there, I mean, I know, I can't remember what the insect is, but I know there's like insects where they've essentially mapped the entire brains of the, yeah, and it's not very many.
Yeah, and again, and it's not very many, and it's, I'm not convinced that just because you can map the brain and predict the behavior, that's the same thing as having access to the actual
phenomenal
mental states. I don't think it is. I don't think that, like, again, it doesn't give you what it's like to be the bat. Even if it projected onto a screen, like, the first-person perspective of what you think that AI's bat, you're describing, like, a computer program's interpretation of an AI, of a bat. You're not actually experiencing what it's like to be a bat subjectively.
Well, you're not experiencing it, but you can know what's happening. Gosh,
I don't think you can.
I wish I could remember. Dennett has a good retort to this, and now I'm blanking on what it is. It's demanding, you're demanding an explanation for something in the exact same form as what the thing is, And I don't think that's necessarily appropriate to demand. I don't think we have to demand that the explanation for someone else's experience or whatever, some subjective experience of something, mm-hmm. is in the language of you have to actually feel it, you know, in order to, for it to be, otherwise it's invalid explanation. I think that's, if I remember right, I think that's where Dennett kind of objects. And similarly, I would say that, like, for the example, you know, think about a computer. You know, we know everything that's going on in a computer, even if there's no monitor plugged in and we're not seeing what it's showing, we still can know with the right, you know, knowledge. And if you're whoever built it or whatever, you have the right knowledge, you know, like, oh, okay, right now it's displaying such and such.
I mean,
that's... to nowhere though, like there's no monitor plugged in, but we know if there were one plugged in, this state of the computer's quote unquote mind correlates with this output or that kind of thing. I think it's similar.
Yeah, I think this, you can correlate objective features to other objective features, but I don't think you can necessarily one-to-one correlate them to subjective features. That's the problem, right? So we can know that, like, it is in a certain objective state, just like I can know that your brain is in a certain objective state of being with certain electrodes, you know, certain parts lighting up at a certain point in time, but I can't provide a perfect correlate. Like, no amount of looking at brain states is going to tell me what it's like, what you're experiencing right now. And I think that, you know, I've never been convinced by any of Dennett's arguments about how we can successfully eliminate the subjective from our ontology. Like, I just think that it's fundamentally impossible. But so I think we should at
least...
Well,
we'll take that as granted. Sure. We can move on.
I think we'll shift away from the, like, mind-body stuff and talk about how this relates specifically to Dr. Manhattan. We'll see if this maybe... See if you like it better on the moral terrain or in the value terrain, because I think another major concern here that ties into this is the fact-value divide and the sort of fundamental question of, is anything valuable from the objective side of things, or does all value rest on the objective side or the subjective side of the objective subjective divide? Because I think what I've always loved about Dr. Manhattan is that, you know, while he gains all this power by being able to truly see the universe from the objective side, it becomes incredibly hard for him to hold on to any sense of valuing anything. And without value, there's no motivation. And so his ability to act is severely compromised, right? Like, in the original series, he connects, he still has sort of the vestiges of his original personality that are sort of slowly fading, is the way I interpret it. And it's being held on to by him, his relationship with Silk Spectre. But, you know, as that breaks down, his connections to the world break down. And so it's an interesting question, I think, of, like, if you really could adopt the fully objective view, like, let's assume that's the good thing to do, right? Give a fully objective account of the universe. Would it include in it any sense of, you know, what we ought to do or what is valuable in the world? And in the show, right, he tries to solve this problem by essentially taking away his ability to see the objective perspective in such a dominant way, right? By giving himself amnesia and an inability to see the future.
Basically, like, converts himself into a human, right, back in order to live that way.
Right. Yeah. Not unlike our Lord Jesus, right? Who experiences the world from a first person personal perspective to get further insights into what it is to live in the world, right? This is a classic mythological trope of gods trying to understand the world by seeing it from the inside, right? From a death takes a vacation once a year and, like, goes and acts as a human being to understand the beings that she's constantly shepherding off to death. There are so many versions of this. And I just, you know, I love the way they do it in the show, where it's like, the idea is that it gives you stakes, right? And it gives you a connection to the actual experiences of the thing. Because if you're always in that objective place, you're always just seeing everything as part of the chains, and it's not, it's hard to hold on to why.
Yeah, you can't live like that.
Right, exactly. It's not
livable. I don't think, and if you take it to an extreme, and that's what I loved about the Dr. Manhattan character, I think in the movie too, where you know, he just can't really be in a relationship anymore. And in the end, didn't it turn out that that was Ozymandias was kind of messing with him or something? Like
he was messing with him, but not on that front. I think on that front, he was just experiencing the genuine like, you know, there's the great quote where he says, like, the number of particles in a living being is the same as the number of particles in a dead being. Functionally, it makes no difference.
Which is really stupid.
Yeah. It's stupid, but it's getting at the idea of, like, from the objective side of things, life doesn't matter any more than a really pretty crystal or something like that, right? It's not inherently more or less valuable. And I think in the original books, they cop out a little bit on this problem, and, like, he decides to act by finding value in incredibly small, rare, random events like the creation of life or a particular individual. But I'm not even convinced that if you really take the problem seriously enough that even that would matter from the objective side of things.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. What I was going to say is you can't live, you know, if you took that to an extreme God's eye view, you know, you wouldn't eat, you wouldn't, you know, how would you maintain your life?
Right.
Because you're not, you wouldn't, any sensation of things you need to do to survive would just be part of this, like, parochial subjective thing that doesn't really matter to you in the grand scheme of things. I don't think it's, you can't effectively be a person that way, I don't think.
Yeah, and I have always, I've developed concerns about things like the Buddhist view of enlightenment because of this same thing, where Nagel brings this up in the chapter about the absurd, that, like, some of the Buddhists or some of the Eastern views of enlightenment are a kind of fully seeing the illusion of the subjective, right? And like, thereby coming to be fully connected to the objective point of view. And there is a lot of work about, like, if you do that, can you still have a life and family and loved ones and something like that? And I'm sort of the view that you kind of can't.
I don't think you can do a good enough job to do it. I also think that part of this discussion, though, sneaks in maybe some sort of underlying moral assumption, you know? Like,
of subjectivism, is that what you mean?
Well, no, even if you want to objectively talk about, like, oh, objectively, what's the right thing versus the subjective, like, what's my right course of action? Still, even either way, you still have to have some baseline moral assumption that, based on the is-ought problem, you didn't get from the world, you know? So, like, an objective, if you're talking about answering a moral question from an objective perspective, you still need some sort of moral baseline assumption. Otherwise, objectively would just be looking at stuff, like, you know, solve this trolley problem objectively. Well, okay, objectively, here's all the facts. There's no solution. Like, it's just, these are the facts. You need that, like, principle of, are you trying to save more people or are you trying to preserve the person at the trolley's switch, like, their, you know, right to not have to kill people, whatever it is. You know, you have to have those moral assumptions in there first, right? Otherwise, it's the is-ought problem and you're just doing is-es.
Well, yeah, and this is one of the big challenges that moral realists like myself face, right? Because, as you know, I believe there are objective moral facts and objective moral truths that are part of the nature of the universe. And so, you know, my view would be,
yeah, that's nonsense.
Yeah, you think that's nonsense, right? But I think that's true. How it's true is a complicated question. But I, at the end of the day, think that, like, you know, it's an objective and not merely subjective fact of the matter that, like, murdering a bunch of people is immoral and you shouldn't do it. And that, like, how we figure out how that could be objective, right, is a hard process. But so that if that were true,
but you start with the answer you want and then you hope you can find a way to make
I think there are more sophisticated arguments than that, but I'm not going to tie our whole episode up in this.
I think there's long since been you might be right, but there's long been, like, a desire among mainly religious people,
yeah, absolutely,
to just assert that, like, no, there's definitely an objective moral fact.
Yep.
And because of that moral fact, objective moral fact, that, by the way, that I can't prove, therefore there's a God, because there has to be, otherwise there wouldn't be this objective moral fact that I just decided exists.
Yeah, anyway, yes.
I know that's not you.
No, I bear the cross of their bad arguments. it is my burden to bear. But yeah, so setting aside whether or not it's true, right? If it were true that there are objective moral facts, then we might think that someone like Dr. Manhattan would have more chance of still being motivated even while being Dr. Manhattan. So a recurring theme in the show that I love is people kind of cracking jokes about how, like, you know, he had all those powers. He could have done a lot more, right? Like, he could have he could have really helped people a lot more. And so the question is, you know, could he have? And if moral facts were objective and true, you might think that, yeah, he could have. Like, he could have, from the universe's point of perspective, realized, you know, a universe without nuclear weapons is better than a universe with them, and blinked them all out of existence, right? And, like, there should be some... He has a reason to do that, is the way I would put this, right? He has... there's an objective reason that he should go ahead and do that. But they choose to, I mean, like, you could just say that the show assumes that there are not objective moral truths because he doesn't feel compelled to act in that kind of way.
I don't know if I really take it that way. I mean, doesn't my read of the character, which absolutely could be wrong, but I thought it was like, well, because there's a line in there that he's like, I don't know that he knew what he was doing at first, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Like, I feel like he... In the show, it seemed like he expressed some regret at his actions back in the 60s or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Like, So it might be that on the continuum that he's on, where he starts off as obviously just a normal subjective being or whatever, and his trend line is toward this, like, God's eye view creature that, you know, can barely have a self, that early on he might have still been more fallible.
Right.
You know, and done stuff for maybe not good reasons or was wrong about reasons. And then eventually my read of the character is that that's that. And then he kind of moved toward this selfless, you know, God's eye view, which led him more to inaction, like to not really caring enough in a way to try to do stuff right. So from that way, I don't know that it would make a claim as to whether or not there are objective moral values, but. Sorry if that's
no, you're right. You know, there could be lots of sort of psychological reasons going, you know, like, because you're right that he is not fully objective, right? He still has. So, like, what I think is really cool is he disappears at one point and goes to the moon of Jupiter and, right, creates a Garden of Eden, but it doesn't work. Like, it doesn't make any sense when he actually does it. He, like, doesn't understand the inner workings of the human heart and mind enough to get what he's actually going for. And I think that's another example of, like, you know, he can see all the particles of the universe, but he can't understand what loving is unless he really adopts the subjective perspective again. And that's why he's driven to go and have that particular relationship.
Why the Garden of Eden? What evidence do we have that there was ever a time when that would work?
it's interesting why he carries over all of these cultural metaphors into his creating of life. And it may be that they just felt like they needed to pick up on the thread at the end of the graphic novel where he says, I'm going to go create life, which is what he said he's going to do. So, but one other thing I want to mention about the show that I really love is, you know, the goals of a couple of characters in the show is to try to steal his power so that they can turn it towards their own objectives. But if we're really to fully understand his problem of not being able to be motivated, it's unclear what would happen if any of them developed his powers, right? That, like, it may just be, if Nagel's right, that if you really develop these powers, then it deprives you of the ability to have a coherent, fully developed motivational structure. And so I think this is what I love about, like, how the ambiguity of the end of the show, it's not clear whether she gets the powers or not. I think that's better than another season where she has the powers, because someone having Dr. Manhattan's powers just breaks things. It doesn't seem to work right because of this subjective-objective divide, whereas sort of that ambiguity allows us to sort of wonder, you know, I guess what I'm saying is, we in our real lives are trapped between the subjective and the objective. We can't abandon one or the other. And so it's of more interest to us ultimately to watch individuals who are struggling between them than individuals, I think, who have an absence of one or the other. Does that make sense?
Sort of. Yeah. I agree. I also agree that not having another season is pretty much always better than having another season for any show. Mm-hmm. As much as we would hate to admit it, I think that's kind of the case, but that's just me.
So I'm I'm sort of ultimately ambivalent on the could he have done better question, both in terms of the motivation and in terms of potentially the methods, right? So, like, you could imagine from his perspective, right? We say, look, why didn't you get rid of all the nukes? And he says, well, if I got rid of all the nukes, people would go back to conventional warfare because there'd be nothing preventing them from mutually assured destruction. So, in genuine, you know, like, even from your limited perspective, right, less nukes isn't actually better than more nukes. So, like, there could just be so many complexities to the universe at this point that, like, you could reasonably argue, even from the bird's eye view, there's no way to improve things potentially. That's sort of a Taoist-y kind of idea, even. I don't fully buy into that. Like, I still think that we could do better and there could be ways to make progress. But maybe the idea is, you know, you can't make progress by just wishing away all the nukes. You have to make progress by changing people's desires to cause harm to each other. And he can't do that. Like, he doesn't have enough, unless he could, like, invent some sort of, I mean, like, I like the idea in Watchmen where he's motivated to try to create a solution to the energy problem. That's what he thinks that he's doing with his research, is that he's trying to, like, solve scarcity. Because, yeah, if you could solve scarcity, then maybe you could really genuinely reduce suffering in some kind of way. But maybe you're just sort of, in the Thanos kind of way, preempting suffering for a little while.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of read it as him not having the will to care about people again. I don't know. I feel like there's plenty he could do. I mean, it's certainly a valid read to say, oh, well, since he knows so much more than us, he sees that actually, you know, the right solution is whatever he does, you know, and that there's that route you could take with the, it just depends on what you want to do as a writer. You know, you could take that route where the reason he's not doing anything is because that's better or something, like he just knows better. Or I it seems like he just is not able to care enough about humans to want to really make that effort. I don't know. It's kind of an interesting, but I love the character. It's really interesting and unique. That's why I really enjoyed the show and the movie, actually. It just was different than pretty much any other superhero-y stuff that I've had to watch. So I love it.
I like at the end when he's trapped in the cage, and it's a cage that, like, controls him by depriving him of any amount of subjectivity. And so he's like, just, he's sort of unstuck in time, experiencing things without being able to control, you know, like any amount of control over where he focuses his attention. That to me is like his problem taken to the furthest, and like it results in him being completely, almost completely incapacitated. And so, yeah. I do think there is something to objectivity being incapacitating. So ultimately, I want to just wrap up here, I guess, a little bit and say, like, there's this desire, there's an understandable desire to try to create a hierarchy between the subjective and the objective. We want to either be able to reduce the objective down to the subjective, which seems unlikely, or more people would more often at this point want to reduce the subjective down to the objective. And I just remain skeptical that it's possible or that it's desirable. And so I think that we need to, and like the alternative is not great either. It means that the world is divided in a fundamental kind of way, and that pieces of knowledge may be irreconcilable in fundamental kinds of ways, and that we are forced to live our lives in a tension that we can't resolve. But I think that's better than resolving it in ways that ignore key remainders that are left over by the resolution into one form or the other.
All right. Well, with that, we've got to hop on over to After Dark. So let's do what we do every time. Hey, what's the preview for next episode?
Well, yeah. So I was thinking for next episode, we should do a eulogy wrap up of The Good Place that has been so very good to us, and talk about, you know, various themes throughout the show and why it has been so meaningful and impactful.
Yeah, fine with me. I'd love to. Cool. Yeah, that finale. So catch up, everybody. Finale just aired last night. I enjoyed it quite a bit. All right. That said, we also need to see what our top patrons at patreon.com/0G are going to make you say this week.
Yeah, special thanks to our $25 tier Strong AI patrons, Dude, Jasta O, Corey Ebert, Winchester's Never Die, Star Wars Episode X, The MacGuffin's MacGuffin's The MacGuffin, Alex Arnett is shopping for a cult compound, and Anna Thumb, Anna Thumb, Anna Thumb, and all the Utils, very special, genuinely bottom of my heart thanks to our top tier, absolutely not clone patrons, Shabbos Gay Services, Don't Pull Your Own Lever on the Sabbath, and Brian, Punch It. Thank you all so very much.
All right. Hey, hop on over to the After Dark. Join us. It's lots of fun. Bonus discussion every single week. Episodes early, you know, like 2 weeks ahead. So plenty of good reasons to hop on over and do it. If not, that's okay. We'll see you next week. All the patrons, we'll see you right now.
That's all for the main show, but if you'd like to go to patreon.com/zeroG, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
Yeah. This is the dong test of quality of new media, and by that metric, Watchmen crushes it.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at ZeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.